All right, welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, Sherry Coolidge, silent fill on the ones and twos. He's got his headphone on. He looks really professional today. You never wear headphones, do you?
You do?
Oh. I don't know. Our special guest today is Cincinnati Public Schools School Board of Education member, Melanie Bates. She's been in the news a little bit lately, so looking forward to having her on as our special guest here in just a few minutes. But first, Sherry, the latest news out of City Hall or in city politics is this $50 million charter.
At least.
$50 million a year
charter amendment.
Charter amendment for affordable housing. It will be on the ballot in May, and it is it's starting to stir the pot a lot. A lot of people are concerned that it could pass, and I'm seeing all three top mayoral candidates, three came out last week against it. And so Democrats, Republicans, business leaders are, I think, really concerned about the fact that this could potentially pass.
I mean, affordable housing, of course, has been a big concern over at City Hall. It really reared its head with the Elm and Liberty Project, the 300 luxury apartments that were approved a couple weeks ago without any affordable housing. And people are long said, we're going to fix this. But I mean, this is a council that created an affordable housing trust fund with hardly any money. They literally basically set it up with $0. But with the promise, we're going to do something. A promise to the groups that really brought forward this charter amendment. And so I understand, honestly, why these groups are frustrated. Because it's been 3 years now and nothing has been really done. It's just affordable housing is a huge fix. It involves a huge influx of money. And so they put this charter amendment forward. Now, a lot of people, I would say most people, mayoral candidates, council people, are like, well, this isn't the fix. But they went out. They got the signatures. I mean, to be fair, it sounds good, right? Who do you want affordable housing in Cincinnati? I mean, who's going to say no to that? The devil's in the details. And that's where we're at this point. Yesterday, we heard from the city manager, Paula Boggs-Muthing, and she did not mince words. She said, if this passes, it will be catastrophic to the city. And yes, I had to look up how to spell that. I'm a terrible speller. But it wasn't great. I mean, she just said this is going to mean massive cuts to the city budget, the police chief, very concerned. And that's kind of where we're at with this. We're looking now. It's definitely going to be on the ballot. The signatures are certified. The question now, what does the language look like?
Yeah, and the council, as we record today, later this afternoon, the council is, I think, scheduled to approve that ballot language. And then it kicks back to the Board of Elections for the final approval. And the Board of Elections has the ability to tweak the language, right, and have the final say. Is it?
The key is they do have the ability. The language has to be true to what the petitions say to voters and really reflect what is being put forward so voters have a clear idea. The idea is you should be able to read your ballot and have a clear understanding of what you're saying yes or no to.
Yeah.
And in this case, that the amount of money comes from very specific places. It's spelled out. Basically, it's going to be the operating budget if this comes to be. And so they have some ability to tweak it, but the signatures are the signatures with this petition drive.
Yeah, I think anyone who objectively looks at this can say, hey, affordable housing is certainly an important issue. It's an important issue across the country. It's something that needs to be addressed. Certainly, Sherry, you and Dan Horn have written a lot about it here in the city. The city council, the mayor, the city administration has really kicked the can on a plan for a long time. And if what comes out of this is a wake-up call for City Hall to kind of lock in and address this, then I think that's a good thing. But this is not the right way to go about it. Citizens can do what they would like to do. Credit the citizens for getting the signatures and all that. This is not good policy. $50 million, blowing a $50 million hole out of the budget, and then having 11 private citizens oversee the money. That's part of the plan is to have a board of a private citizens to oversee spending and managing the money. It's like, yeah, no. Given all the corruption that's happened at City Hall and the graft, not the right approach. But yeah. And ultimately, I think under too, I wrote this over the weekend, is that it's some of the same folks who were behind the defund the police movement last summer are behind this charter amendment. So interestingly, they're not asking for a tax increase. So I think that also has folks concerned about the potential of it passing. But they're not asking for a reason. They want to fundamentally change how the city spends its money and change the budget. And as you said, the city, the people who do this for a living, say it will be catastrophic to the budget. But we'll be following your coverage on this as we lead up to the May 4th election, because that's when it, as I understand, that's when it'll be on the ballot, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
It's a primary issue. I mean, look for the next question really to be not, do you support this charter amendment? Okay, you don't support this charter amendment. What's your plan for affordable housing? That has to be the conversation.
With that, let's jump over, bring on school board member Melanie Bates. All right, special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. I'm pleased to welcome the podcast for the first time, Board of Education member, the longest tenured member on the school board, Melanie Bates. Hey, Melanie.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us here today. Nothing's going on, right?
No, just another boring day in Cincinnati.
Well, so, Melanie, how long have you been on? I have lost track of time, I have to tell you. I got to know you a little bit back in 2005, but how long have you been on the school board?
This is my 20th year on the Cincinnati Board of Education, and I spent 7 years on the State Board of Education right before that. So 26 plus years in school board service.
What made you get involved in school board?
Well, I was one of those moms out there that, wanted to get involved and help my school. And it became pretty obvious that the way you make change is, through the Board of Education. You can't make change at the school level, at least not significant change, because you run into barriers. So to eliminate any barriers to change, the change has to come from the top. It really does.
And your career was in hospital administration, hospital fundraising?
Well, it was nonprofit work.
Okay.
So in my infinite wisdom, and my husband thought I was crazy, when I had two kids in college, I decided that I wanted to go back to college too so we could have three tuition payments. So I enrolled in the Northern Kentucky University Master of Administration program and received my master's there, and also a certificate in nonprofit management, and then went on to work for Life Center Organ Donor Network. And my job there was to provide donation education to hospital staff, physicians, administration, and help develop policy for the hospitals around the donation process.
That's
so
awesome.
It was healthcare. Every day I was in ICUs.
Wow.
talking about donation.
And you said as a mom, you wanted to get involved on the school board. Was there something that happened at that time that really sparked you and motivated you to get, like, I've got to run for school board? Was there some kind of a, I don't know, big issue in the news with the schools at the time that really kind of pushed you that direction?
Well, it was mostly centered around budget cuts. Back in the early 90s, there were massive budget cuts, and middle school athletics were cut, like gone, X'd out, and it took years to rebuild the athletic programs in Cincinnati public schools. But it's like, wow, how can that happen? You know, because that's such a significant experience for students. And then another, this was probably the straw that broke the camel's back, was, you know, a music program, the Suzuki music program, was being cut. And it really didn't cost that much. It was just one of the line items. And it was, the rationale did not seem to match the effect that it was, you know, that was anticipated. So those, it was mostly, you know, elimination of programs that, you know, that myself and other members of the community thought were valuable.
So kind of in the 2000s then, your family was really active in the community. Your whole family, your husband, Phil, and you really, I think, just kind of were sprung into the news with the terrible death of your husband.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that people don't know now, when we're talking about everything that's happening so much, about what you've gone through with everything.
Right. I mean, Phil was very active in the hockey community in particular, and helped build that citywide, or actually area-wide program. To this day, one of my sons still coaches soccer. I was instrumental in the organization and, you know, work of the soccer association in town. Another son is still involved in hockey. You know, I after my husband's death was just so motivated. I ran for city council. I think I came in 11th. During my first run,
and got and involved. He was killed outside your North Avondale home. Just
right.
He had come back from a vigil for someone else who died. It was a high crime year that year, and it did. You were paying a lot of attention to the crime at that point.
Oh yes, definitely. You mean before, after, during?
I mean,
we were certainly aware of what was occurring in the community. And then afterwards, it was like, wow. You know, that year was the highest number of homicides next to 2020. So I think 2020 exceeded that year.
What year was that?
2006. So yeah, that was a terrible year for our community. And actually, I will always be beholden to John Cranley for this. When we decided, my friends and community members decided to go to City Hall, have a press conference, and speak at a city council meeting, there was and we were demanding, you know, more protection. And during that meeting, John Cranley made the motion to increase the police force by 100 officers. Or as a result, there were 100 officers added. So, yeah, we
he was the budget chairman then.
What's that?
I think he was the budget chairman back then. He was
on
council.
Oh, yeah. So, I was active in the anti-crime, anti-homicide movement. I'm, you know, to this day, a supporter of the police. I have I'm a proud aunt of a nephew who is on the Toledo Police Force. So, I'm very, very much in tune with what's going on in the community to this day regarding crime and, you know, homicides in particular.
And then, I mean, now you're on school board, you continue with all of that work all of this time, and it's long, I mean, the biggest conversation about education at CPS has actually been about education, right? Moving the needle, improving our schools. We're an urban district in the state. The funding is always an issue. And it's been just kind of the same issue for years with moving it, you know, to become better, until this year when it's a pandemic. And it really has thrust the school board members, like, into the forefront of making decisions about a pandemic that nobody really knows anything about. A year ago, right? We're a year 1 year ago, and you're being asked to make decisions with not a lot of information. What was that like?
Well, it's difficult because we have seven people with seven different interpretations of the information and data. We have varying sources. We have the CDC, you know, with quote unquote recommendations, but they're not mandates. We have local control of our schools, yet we're getting strong, quote unquote guidance from the governor. And it's just, it's very, very complicated.
So you were certainly in the news last week, and the concerns about, or you, let's go back to January, and you really started to be vocal about the fact, let's start moving into a plan to reopen the schools.
Yes.
And you came under fire from the teachers' union for that. And you referenced the CDC, and the CDC under Trump and the CDC under Biden, and the state has done a study, and all these other school districts are open. And it seemed like a logical thing for you to start to, vocalize that, right? To let's move toward 5 days a week here.
Right. And that's my typical style. I've come under fire for other initiatives and decisions that I've been very vocal about. So yes, that was definitely my my opinion, was that we should move forward, because in our local districts that are not CPS districts, the other public school districts, the students were 3 feet apart, 3 to 6 feet apart, I should say. Their teachers were unvaccinated. They were following strict protocols. And the transmission in school just was so minimal. And our children, I know, their families are applying to these schools. They're moving. They're putting, they're getting on wait lists for parochial schools. And it was pretty obvious that there's a large group of families that really want 5-day-a-week school. And I support that. I support choices. You know, if people feel very uncomfortable with that, you know, we need to beef up our remote option. You know, if people think that the digital academy is for them, I support that. But we had no option for families that want to go back 5 days a week. So yes, I became a very vocal supporter for that.
And it just became hundreds of people coming to speak at public comment. Then there's protests and counter protests, and you know, with everybody having their say, which is important. But it came to a breaking point for you. It feels like you're out.
It was not just the public comment, but it was the social media comments. I mean, I'll even go so far as to say that there was harassment when people put up memes of school board members with comments as their profile pages, and not just myself, but other school board members. That's not acceptable. So there was this, I'd say, kind of vicious conversation going on to discredit school board members, and I got caught up in that.
Well, that goes back to, that's pretty typical union tactics there. And you've been very supportive of the union for all these years, and now do you feel a little like, this is common sense here, what you're saying. And again, it's not just like you're going out on a limb and saying this with no data or no doctors or no recommendations or no other school districts. Like, to me, it seems like this is it's a cliche, but a no-brainer for you to push for this.
Well, it's a combination of people. I know that Julie Sellers has been very vocal about, you know, extremely low risk for her teachers. You know, and if we talk in terms of risk, I've been more, you know, my stance is, you know, let's do low risk, not no risk. You get in a car and there's a low risk. If you obey, you know, the traffic laws, you'll get into an accident. But if you don't want to get into a car accident, you don't get into a car. You know, it's
right.
Unfortunately, we're talking about the same thing here.
How close do you think that we are to kids going back, like maybe 4 days a week? That seems to be the conversation this week seems to be headed that way.
Yeah, we told the superintendent, the board let the superintendent know that we have to let know soon. You know, and March 16th seems to be the line in the sand. And we need to align that with the magnet school lottery. Parents are on wait lists for other private schools. They have to make a decision. You know, people are putting their homes up on the market. I know that's going on. I get texts and DMs and, you know, emails about this all the time. Our kids are not doing well. Many are not doing well in remote. Our fall English Language Arts Ohio State test data is in. And in the fall of 2019, this is the beginning of the school year. So this is the baseline. Last 2019, 38% of the students assessed were at or above proficient level. After being out of school since March, this fall, 21% of the students assessed were at or above the proficient level. So,
how does that make you feel as a mother?
Well, I have grandkids in this system. I have two grandchildren in Cincinnati Public Schools. I have a daughter who's a first grade teacher in another public school district. So, you know, it's in conversations, the difference between what that district is providing 5 days a week to their students and what we are is just devastating. Our children, I'd say in many, many cases, you know, are a year behind.
Gosh.
Do you feel like there's a big effort to kind of find these kids who aren't even in the remote learning? Like that plays into these low numbers because that number is a shocking number to me. And we've heard like the number over time, like 5,000 kids didn't log in. Is there like an effort to find these kids and what's going on with that?
Well, I believe there's an ongoing effort to find these kids. But even if they log in, you know, what's the proof that they're actually progressing? So, yes, there is an effort and school by school there is. But, you know, it's what the district attendance rate year to date as of, you know, this February last year was pre-COVID 91%. This year, 86%. And that's logins. That's not, you know, grades or assessments.
It's hard to hear. Like that's a number that we have to track now. And it is now not about, well, how much did they learn? What is their reading level? And like, this is a very stark moment in Cincinnati history, I think. And it's to matter for years. Like it doesn't end, oh, the school year is over and then the problem goes away. I mean,
well, not only that, but I'd say the majority of our schools are community learning centers. And when we rebuilt all of our schools in the facilities master plan, rebuilt and renovated every school in our district, we had additional space put in for partners, for health services, mental health services, vision, dental. We even have an urgent care for the community in Sailor Park. And our partner who coordinates this Growing Well let us know last week that referrals are way, way down. So kids are not just, you know, not receiving adequate, you know, learning experiences. They're not getting their health services and mental health services. So it's a bigger problem than just being a year behind.
So I want to clarify something. You said you're moving toward a date of March 16th at looking at the decision on reopening. Are you talking about for this, the remainder of this school year, or are you talking about for next school year?
Both.
Okay.
Both, yeah. For fourth, probably fourth quarter or post spring break, and then letting parents know that next year, they barring another catastrophe, that they can rely on this schedule. And it's, you know, and if this is the schedule, these are the choices, you know, and hopefully the choices will include, you know, in-school instruction. That's, you know, what one of the, this is the recommend, not the recommendation, but a proposal from the superintendent, you know, in-school instruction, Cincinnati Digital Academy, and the board is requesting, demanding a more robust remote school options for families. So providing three options for families, depending on what, where those families are and their comfort level with the pandemic.
As you sit here today in your heart of hearts, are you optimistic that the Cincinnati Public Schools will go back in the fourth quarter 5 days a week?
If we have, I think that the board would support this for pre-K through eight, I believe, because the transmission rate is so low. I can't predict votes of the board, and I haven't talked to other board members about what they're going to do. But that seemed like there was more of a comfort level with pre-K through eight than the high school, because especially with the, you know, the social distancing at the high school, more of a safety feature. But it's, you know, I'm optimistic that we could provide a better choice than we have right now with the blended learning, and then, you know, continue to expand remote. And Cincinnati Digital Academy went from about, what, 500 students to 1,700 students within a year. That's unbelievable. And, you know, and it's unbelievable that we're able to support that. That kind of expansion. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
So that does bring us to the question of the hour. Are you going to run again and keep doing that work?
Well, before my controversy, as we say, I was ready to, you know, announced that I was not going to run. I'm kind of re-energized at this point. but I'm not ready to make an announcement because there'll be a mom divorce if my kids hear it on your podcast before I consult with them.
We understand. We heard the same thing from Christopher Smitherman when we're like, are you running for mayor? He's like, I have to talk to my kids. Family's important when it comes to making a decision that really, as we know, you're talking about the social media, and Jason and I both know, that really puts you out there in the public eye for the good or the bad. All right. So just make sure that you tell Maddie Mitchell, the Inquirer's education reporter, when you have your decision there.
I will, for sure.
Well, Melanie, thanks so much for joining today. And really, this is my own opinion on this, is a thank you for, you know, speaking up for children on this and the need of getting back to school. As a dad myself with a kid in elementary school, not in the CPS, but thanks for what you're doing in this realm.
Oh, well, it's my pleasure to serve. So I'm doing my best.
All right, thanks again to our special guest, Melanie Bates, this week. Sherry, that brings us to our That's So Cincinnati moment of the week. Technically, this is the That's So Cincinnati moment of 2 weeks ago. A little less than two weeks ago.
Since I know what it is, it counts because it's That's So Cincinnati moment of all time. So,
and that is that I took my 8-year-old son to Price Hill Chili for the first time, and he absolutely loved it.
Are we supposed to be shocked? We're not shocked, are we?
No, we're not shocked. But the thing is that Price Hill Chili is a little spicier than Skyline, and he's not a
big
fan.
This is where it becomes really That's So Cincinnati. Here come the nuances.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Pricil chili is the spiciest of all the chilies. This is in my opinion. Steve Beltzos says he thinks Camp Washington. Steve Beltzos, the owner of Pricil Chili, says he thinks Camp Washington's is a little spicier. I would beg to differ. But anyway, we are getting down a very so Cincinnati hole when we're talking about the spiciness of Cincinnati chili. My son, so it's funny. I apparently talk about Pricil Chili enough to where he had a basketball game. It would be two Sundays ago at the Friars Club in St. Bernard. And it ended at like noon. And I said, oh, well, you want to go to lunch? Yeah. He's like, how about Pricil Chili? And I was like, okay. And so while we're on our drive there, he says, do you think Steve will be there? And I'm like, Steve, like, how do you know about Steve? He's like, well, you've talked about him enough.
Oh, they're listening. They're listening. I feel like if we ask Jack who the nine council members are, I bet he could name like seven of them. Which I'm not sure everyone in Cincinnati could actually do, but they're listening. They know.
So I took Reed to Pricil Chili. He got a big old plate of chili cheese fries and a cheese coney, no onion, and woofed the whole thing down. And he loved it, and it was great. And God, I've been back.
Goodness forbid that the onions come on, like Skyline or wherever we're having chili. Like if the onions are there, you got to drive back. It's a crisis.
I will take it a step further and say, even if like one little onion slips in, because sometimes one little onion will slip in on a cheese coney, and it's chaos. I don't know what's the right word. It's not good. But anyway, that's at Brand X, by the way. That's not at Pricil Chili. Pricil Chili never drops onions. I'm kidding.
See what I mean?
We love the nuances. I love it all.
All right.
I love all of it. I love some of it better than others. As we know, I did my chili tour last year. We need to get our bud Keith Pandolfi to do a chili tour.
I feel like that's coming. It's a classic for the food writers. You know what though? I think he should wait until you know more of the pandemic subsides. He does. If you read, like, he's writing a lot of like writing, like you know our memories of our important you know food institutions, and like for some of these places like Pricil Chili, you got to go in and get the atmosphere. Yep. I mean, I love walking by all of the old newspaper stories on the walls and like the history of it and the, like just the politics of it. Like you can get takeout and taste the chili, but the atmosphere matters there too.
You know, I didn't know this. And so I've been back to Pricil Chili at least twice since I took my son. Yesterday was one of them.
Remember, this was 2 weeks ago, so he's been back twice. Okay.
And Steve starts telling me the history of his dad. I'm not going to get too far into this, but that the politicians would go up there because it was like, you know, they could go to a place where they could have conversations with people or like meet with people and then, but not be somewhere downtown where they would see all these people that would know them. And so they wouldn't be bothered. Like you could go have a meeting and just enjoy a beer or a plate of chili, but a three-way or something. And like he starts telling me all these stories about all these old school politicians, like local. And I'm like, back in the day, he's like, oh, the clerk of courts, so and so, was like friends with my dad. And I'm like, I've never heard of that person, but it's almost 59 years old, Pricil Chili. So, 50, it'll be 59, I believe, this fall. But anyway, I love the place, as you guys know. And thank you for loving this podcast. Catch you next week.